From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Michelle Martin in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The world gathered in Brazil or around television screens for World Cup and left politics mostly at home for the Olympic Games in Sochi. LeBron James came home to Cleveland. Derek Jeter hung up his cleats in New York. And this year's sports stories also made headlines for all the wrong reasons. Domestic abuse, racial epithets, even child abuse. At times, the usual banter about rivalries and pride was replaced by painful conversations about what exactly is the role of sports in our lives and what should it be. We'll look at it all this hour on Point, the top sports stories of 2014. You can join us on air or online. What tops your list of this year's sports stories? What made you cheer or jeer? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With me in the studio is Shira Springer. She is a sports reporter and columnist for the Boston Globe. Shira Springer, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And joining us now from Washington, D.C. is Kevin Blackistone, sports writer and panelist on the ESPN show Around the Horn. He is a professor of sports journalism at the University of Maryland, and if you don't mind my mentioning it, was a frequent contributor to the Tell Me More Barbershop Roundtable. Kevin Blackistone,
yep, yep.
Welcome to On Point. That's right.
You
get the yep, yep. Very well. Better now.
Good.
All right. So, Kevin, what's your overall assessment of the year in sports? When you think about this year in sports, was it a, you know, source of inspiration, or was it really mainly a source of pain?
I think it mainly as a source of monumental change, right? So pain maybe for those who control sports, but gain maybe for those who are the participants in it. In a lot of ways. I think, you know, first off, how we start out the year talking about college sports and how much control the NCAA has over the athletes in college and the lawsuits that that got settled in court and out of court that exposed the hypocrisy of the NCAA. Left its argument that it's for amateurs only, really in shreds. But I also think about how we're ending the year and the empowerment that athletes are finding, maybe surprisingly, in themselves, protesting and garnering support for their protest over police violence against black men in this country. For one, over their ability to fight bigotry and racism in sports successfully, when you look at the ouster of Donald Sterling from the NBA. And then in between, obviously, you have the situation with Ray Rice and Adrian Peterson.
Okay. Well, we're going to talk about all of that stuff. So let's let Shira give her answer to, you know, overall, when you're going to write your big end of year, you know, roundup, what do you think the theme is going to be?
I like Kevin's idea of a year of monumental change, and I see that particularly with women in athletics. I think you can look at Monet Davis, the Little League pitcher, who's astounded us all by taking her team deep into the Little League World Series. And then there were also maybe events that didn't quite register as much in the headlines, but were still breakthroughs for women at the Winter Olympics in Sochi. You had ski jumpers, female ski jumpers, competing in the Olympics for the first time. You also had record number of women competing in the Olympics, in the Winter Olympics. And then there was Becky Hammon, who was hired by the San Antonio Spurs as the first full-time female NBA assistant coach. So there were a lot of breakthroughs for women in sports this year. And I think that will be one of the things I will take away in the monumental change area, in addition to all of the pain and controversy and sort of black marks on the sports world.
Well, let's talk about some of those, some of that pain and controversy and kind of get that out of the way. And it also fits into your theme, Kevin, too, of change and the way we talk about some of these issues. I mean, well, let's just start with a story that a lot of people are interested in, which is Adrian Peterson. I think many people remember that in November, the Minnesota Vikings running back, he pleaded no contest to misdemeanor reckless assault. He was in the spotlight because he punished his 4-year-old son with a switch, and the child's mother said that he left the child injured, and this is what he had to say.
I truly regret this incident. I stand here and I take full responsibility for my actions. I love my son more than any one of you. could even imagine.
Yeah, it's important to point out that a lot of people responded to the story. Obviously, a lot of people responded to the story as parents, but even people that you don't necessarily would think you would go to for a conversation about this were very, very affected by it. I just want to play another clip. This is ESPN's Chris Carter, a former Minnesota Viking. He got very emotional during an NFL countdown show in September when he talked about, you know, his own experience with this issue. And here he's talking about being disciplined by his mother. And here's that clip.
My mom did the best job she could do, raising seven kids by herself. But there are thousands of things that I have learned since then that my mom was wrong.
Yes. Thank you.
It's the 21st century. My mom was wrong. She did the best she could, but she was wrong about some of that stuff she taught me. And I promise my kids I won't teach that mess to them. You can't be the kid to make them do what they want
to do. That's correct. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thousands of things we have learned since then.
What do you think, Kevin? I mean, is something like this a teachable moment, not just for people who are actively involved in sports, but for the country, for anybody watching this?
Yeah, I think it is a teachable moment. You know, it's interesting the spotlight that sports can put on issues in society like nothing else. We've been concerned about disciplining children for a very long time. You know, there's a evangelical Christian couple that wrote a very controversial book several years ago. I think it's called Train Up a Child, in which they encourage people to beat and whip their children. And that book has become part of several lawsuits, criminal lawsuits, where children have died. Because of parents who have put that book to practice. Mm. Yet the face of child abuse now is Adrian Peterson in this country. And it's very, very troubling. So it is a teachable moment. And people are talking about child abuse now more than ever before. I thought the real story about Adrian Peterson was overlooked. And the real story to me in Adrian Peterson is the fact that he is an athlete, or really just a man, who's a father to a bunch of kids around the country by different women, including a 2-year-old who he saw for the first time just before the child died in a coma. He's the one who's in need of the discipline and not the child. And so once again, this gets back to the issue of masculinity, the issue of what it is to be a black man, I think, in this country. Just some issues that need to be dealt with in an interracial conversation, and not necessarily the conversation around Adrian Peterson's criminality in this particular case.
Well, you know, to that end, though, and sure, I haven't forgotten about you, but, you know, to that end, though, of course, the other big sports story around behavior is the Ray Rice story, suspended from the league after a video was released showing him knocking his then fiance, now his wife, unconscious. He appealed the suspension. He's now free to play. He's looking for a team and has recently kind of started, I guess you'd call it maybe a public relations offensive to try to achieve that end. There was a very heavily promoted interview with NBC's Today Show that also involved his wife and her mother. But I just want to play just a short clip from what Ray Rice had to say when he was asked what he thought it would take for an NFL team to sign him.
They would have to be, you know, willing to, you know, look deeper into who I am and realize that, you know, me and my wife had one bad night and I took full responsibility for it. And one thing about my punishment and everything going along with anything that happened is that I've accepted it. I went fully forward with it. I never complained or I never did anything like that. I took full responsibility for everything that I did. And only thing I can hope for and wish for is a second chance.
So, Kevin, just stick with me for a minute here. I'm sure this brings up a lot for you. I mean, I'm guessing we could actually spend a whole hour talking about what this brings up for
right.
you. But just briefly, I know you mentioned earlier kind of there's a racial component, the fact that, you know, we know that domestic violence is something that affects a lot of people in this country. And yet, you know, once again, now the face of this seems to be another African-American man. I'm sure that's troubling for you. But other than that, from a football perspective, is there some perspective you want to bring to this?
Well, I just think that Ray Rice has been dealt with because of his own doing somewhat unfairly. And he has been he's gone through the adjudication process, which was afforded him as a first-time offender. He's been penalized by the NFL twice. And, you know, I think that he is due an opportunity to regain his employment in the work that he does and has done so well. And obviously the league has made adjustments to try and deal with this particular issue going forward in terms of how to penalize players who are arrested for felonies or even misdemeanors. It's a very, very troubling thing. And I think that the Baltimore Ravens and I think the NFL should be giving him an opportunity to play again rather than trying to give him a stiff arm and keep him out of the league.
Sure. I know you have thoughts about this as well. We need to take a short break soon. You just want to get started and then we'll pick up with you after our break?
Yeah, I think one of the things that stuck out to me with Ray Rice, aside from all the domestic abuse issues, was also looking at how Roger Goodell handled it in comparison to how Adam Silver in the NBA handled the Don Sterling situation. It was a real contrast in leadership styles.
This is On Point. I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the year in sports. The Ice Bucket Challenge rules the summer, and athletes jump in. The entire New York Jets team takes the Ice Bucket Challenge. University of Connecticut basketball gets an NCAA title for the women and the men.
Best program college basketball right now, ever was, ever will be. Kevin Ollie, best coach ever. Let's go.
And South African Olympian Oscar Pistorius, convicted for culpable homicide of his girlfriend, manslaughter in the U.S. The prosecutor tried to force him to look at what he'd done, and Pistorius broke down.
I will not look at a picture where I'm tormented by what I saw and felt that night. As I picked Reva up, my fingers touched her head. I remember. I don't have to look at a picture. I was there.
We're talking the year in sports, and you can join the conversation. What moved you? Joining us are Kevin Blackstone, sports writer and panelist for the ESPN show Around the Horn, and Shira Springer's columnist and sports reporter for the Boston Globe. And before we took a break, Shira, we were talking about the, you know, many of the stories that touched on big social issues that seem to kind of manifest themselves or play out in the world of sports. Before we took our break, we were talking about the, you know, the domestic
leadership,
violence and
the
child abuse cases and how they were handled, you know, by the NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell. You were making the point of really contrasting that with the way the NBA handled some of its icky issues.
Yes. I mean, I think when you look at the way Adam Silver came out in that press conference and banned Donald Sterling, the former owner of the LA Clippers, for life, you saw a man whose apology was incredibly heartfelt and his action was very strong, quick, and decisive. Whereas when Roger Goodell came out for his press conference in the wake of the Ray Rice incident, you saw a man who it seemed was still protecting the NFL shield and doing things more for publicity, you know, PR moves than he was doing things for actual strong action.
How do you interpret that? Do you interpret this as an issue of the character of leadership of these individuals, or does it say something about the way these leagues operate as institutions?
Both, but I think it also says a lot about the character of the two leaders of the two leagues. I think Goodell is very, very profit-oriented, and it's a bottom-line league where he is trying to make as much money as possible for his owners. I mean, the league now brings in about $10 billion annually, and he wants that figure to keep going up, and so he needs to protect that.
Sure. Stay with me for a minute. Kevin mentioned earlier that this was a year in which athletes, you know, found their voices, and we're going to talk about that in a minute. But I wonder if less famous athletes did too, like the people who ran the Boston Marathon this year after the bombing. Let's just play a short clip from 38-year-old Meb Keflezighi. He won the Boston Marathon and was the first American man to win it since 1983. Let's hear a minute about that. Mm-hmm.
right here.
Cliff Kozlowski wins the Boston Marathon.
Unbelievable. Who cares what time it is? It's unbelievable.
So special for a number of reasons, Shira. Talk about it.
Well, special largely because it was the first year, it was the one-year anniversary of the Boston Marathon bombings that took place at the finish line in 2013. It was special, as you heard there, because Meb Keflezighi was the first American male winner in 31 years. And what people were really wanted to see when the marathon took place this year was how would the city react? How would the runners react? How would the fans react? And as a runner in this year's marathon, I can tell you it was an absolutely overwhelming experience from start to finish, from the moment Meb won the race to what you experienced all along the course, which was very unique and I believe unprecedented in any marathon, which was fans yelling at you, thank you, thank you, thank you for running. And marathon runners, as they're passing line, you know, 10 deep rows of fans saying thank you back to the
thank
fans.
You for, can I get into your business for a second?
Sure.
Did your family ask you not to run? Did anybody in your life say, I really wish you'd rather not?
No, I think they were actually more concerned about me heading over to the Sochi Olympics and they were running along the streets of Boston. I think everything they had heard and everything I had reported on the marathon indicated that the city, the police, the race organizers were extraordinarily well prepared and that it would, you know, be a very, very secure race.
Kevin, go back to the point that you made earlier, that this was a year in which athletes were making their voices heard. Why do you think that is? You know, for years, the attitude was politics and sports don't mix.
Right.
We know that has not always been the case. But this, it, you know, for years, there's the famous Michael Jordan quote that, you know, Republicans mm-hmm. buy sneakers, too, when he was asked to weigh in on a race in his home state of North Carolina, where a very qualified African-American candidate was running against an incumbent who was, many people felt, was racially insensitive, to say the least, and he declined to get involved. What's made the difference now? And what is it that causes you to say that something's changed?
You know, I think I've got to look at social media. I think social media changed so many things this year. And I think because athletes are so heavily involved in social media that they thankfully got caught up in it. When the Donald Sterling story came out, his pillow talk conversations came out, a lot of people in social media were very, very critical of the league, the NBA, Donald Sterling in particular. And I think pressure was brought upon these players to make a statement. And quite frankly, the outpouring of protest against Donald Sterling and disgust was so overwhelming that it made it safe for players to come out and denounce him as they did, and to come out before a game and throw their Clippers shirts at midcourt and then walk away.
Can I ask you a question, though? Can I ask a question about this? Because remember, some of this activism, an early kind of indicator of this activism was when the Miami Heat took a picture wearing their hoodies after the killing of Trayvon Martin and after there was no conviction in that case. LeBron James on that team at that time, one of the people outspoken about Donald Sterling, LeBron James,
right.
Recently wearing T-shirts in New York. He's now back with his former team, the Cleveland Cavaliers, wearing T-shirts when they played in New York saying, I can't breathe, in acknowledgement of the Eric Garner case where he was killed in an encounter with police, no indictment. The through line here, LeBron James. So,
LeBron James,
so the question
yeah.
I have for you is the same question I had for Shira. Is this a question of individual leadership and a person really his own personal individual leadership and the quality of his leadership? Or is it something institutionally that has changed that is causing this stuff to move forward? Your thoughts?
Well, I think that LeBron James has become the vanguard in this leadership. I'm glad you pointed that out because he did spearhead the Trayvon Martin hoodie photograph with the Heat. He did in the off season before we heard from the new union chief of the NBA talk to players behind closed doors about what he felt was an inequitable financial situation between players and ownership in the NBA. He did come out more vociferously than any other player in this league when talking about Donald Sterling and vowing not to play in the NBA if Donald Sterling was still connected with it. And he did the other day come out very strongly about the situation in Ferguson, about the situation in New York, and about the situation overall with the brutality that black men his age in this country face when confronted with police. So he, and not only that, but he even went one step further, which I think was missed by a lot of people, and that was in his return to Cleveland in explaining why he did so. It was in very nationalistic terms. He talked about wanting to help educate young men and women in Northeast Ohio so that they could become productive citizens in the state of Ohio. I mean, he was talking about, in a sense, nation building. So I've been very impressed with the maturation process of LeBron James.
Well, let's go. Let's take a call now. We've been asking what On Point listeners what their favorite or most important sports moment of the year was. And here's Marco calling from Arlington, Massachusetts. Marco, what was your favorite sports story of the year?
Yeah, hi. Excuse me. My favorite sports story was the success of the Costa Rican men's soccer team in the World Cup. You know, this is a country that long has been praised for its democratic process and long been praised for having, you know, gotten rid of its own army, but largely seen kind of as a tourist attraction. And for a country like this to not only advance, but to pretty soundly defeat some of the established powers in soccer and to get within, you know, a moment of practically getting to the semifinals, it just confirmed everything about how soccer is a great equalizer between nations, and it is the sport of nations. And I don't think anyone who watched them play this year, other than the teams that they defeated, could help but root for them. I think it was just a breathtaking performance by an incredibly courageous team that spoke volumes about the country and about the sport.
You know, there are a lot of great plays during World Cup. In the round two match, Jermaine Jones scored the first goal for the USA against Portugal, tying up the game in the second half. Let's listen to that.
Jones. Oh, yes! Jermaine Jones! What a cracker from him! USA level!
Now, there was a lot of World Cup fever in the U.S. this year for the first time. I know that there are some debates in offices. I know there were some jokes on the late night talk shows about whether anybody was really going to watch World Cup or not. I'm firmly in the World Cup camp. I'll just tell you that in the spirit of full disclosure. Now, this is crowds in Kansas City. I'm just looking for validation here. So that's why I've pulled these clips, just to be sure that, you know, I'm not alone here. Crowds in Kansas City erupted in celebration while watching the U.S. play. Here's that. Now, Cher, don't feel you have to agree with me just because you're sitting here with me. But okay.
I agree. No, I'm a big soccer fan, and I was one of those people who during the opening round, I was, you know, glued to my television watching game after game after game. And I agree with the caller, Marco, I believe, who was talking about Costa Rica's run. What I love about the World Cup and loved this year was all the underdog stories, and that included the U.S. I mean, don't forget, this was a team where its coach, Jurgen Klinsmann, came out and before the tournament and said, I don't believe we will win the World Cup, which there was tremendous backlash to that. And then U.S. fans, as the team got out of the group of death and advanced the round of 16, adopted the chant, I believe we can win. I mean, it was a very powerful, patriotic, nationalistic experience. But it wasn't only the U.S. that was having these triumphant moments. There was Greece. There was Iran with its moments. Costa Rica, as was mentioned. Mexico had a great game against Brazil. There were plenty of great moments and lots of nationalistic pride, which is always exciting to watch and see how far people travel to support their teams. I mean, I couldn't believe how many people showed up in the middle of the Amazon to cheer on their teams.
Kevin, do you think that the U.S. has finally got World Cup fever for good? Has it taken hold? I can't remember whether you're a World Cup hater or not. I don't remember.
No. I enjoy the World Cup. I've covered a few of them, and I was glued to my television set for most of this one. I think it's an event now. And, you know, even when you look back at the Women's World Cup, that became an event. And some of those games became the largest watched soccer games in this country. So I think people are now, I think it's now an accessible sport, and it's a fun sport, and it brings great spectacle, creates great spectacle. And I think that's one of the reasons that we're so drawn for it. And I also think that soccer translates well on television. The color, the music, the pageantry, and the roller coaster of excitement within a game when you see a chance is being developed and then a ball doesn't make it into the net by inches. I think we enjoy that. So we love the event of the World Cup.
Yeah, briefly, sure. There's another big story that the Women's World Cup is going to be held next year in Canada on turf fields. Really controversial. Can you tell us why?
Incredibly controversial. For the first time, a men's or women's World Cup, it happens to be the 2015 Women's World Cup in Canada, is going to be held on artificial turf, a very unforgiving surface. If you've ever seen a player after they've played on artificial turf, their knees are scraped, their shins are bruised and bloody. And the women filed a lawsuit this fall, basically asking FIFA and the Canadian Sports Association to replace the artificial turf with grass because they believe there's gender bias there. And I have to agree with them because they are playing on an inferior surface. They are expected to showcase their game to the world on an inferior surface, and it's simply unfair. And I'd have to say I'm not the only one who thinks that. And speaking of athlete activism, Kobe Bryant and Kevin Durant have been on social media tweeting about this and saying that it's unfair and that FIFA needs to do something.
Hmm. Before we let you go for this segment, though, Shira, I know you wanted to highlight another big international sporting event this year, the Sochi Winter Olympics. Lots happened outside of the games. You know, the politics, Bob Costas's pink eye, you know, the stray dogs, the complaints about where some of the facilities were. I don't want to be any more explicit than that. You know,
the bobsled breaking through the bathroom, I think, was sort of the highlight. The bathroom door, because he was locked in, was sort of one of the highlights of the Olympics.
But I know you wanted to highlight Michaela Schifrin. This is 18-year-old skier Michaela Schifrin after the run that made her the youngest woman to win gold in the giant slalom at the Olympics, in the slalom at the Olympics. Here it is. Mm-hmm.
One of my greatest goals has always been to be the youngest to do something. So I knew that if I won today, I'd be the youngest to win a slalom in the Olympics. But I wasn't really thinking about that when I was going out of the start. I was just trying to ski my very best. But when it happened, I was like, yes, okay, check that off the list.
That was never on my list. I don't know. I missed that. But what was another highlight for you, Shira? Why was this one a good highlight
for you?
Well,
this one was a great highlight. I happened to be at the bottom of the run when she was winning her gold medal. And what I remember very distinctly is she had a clear bobble in the middle of her run. And there was a gasp from the crowd because we all thought she had let the gold medal slip through her fingers. And then with maturity way beyond her 18 years, she recovered and captured the gold and in a history-making fashion. Other highlights for me, as I mentioned before, the women competing in ski jumping was just such an emotional event for these women, who some of whom had waited, you know, 15, 20 years for their opportunity to have this stage. There was also the men's hockey game, USA-Russia, a rematch, so to speak, of the Miracle on Ice, which was incredibly hyped over there and here. I also thought that one of the great sporting events that I went to was the women's gold medal match between the USA and Canada in hockey that ended up in a U.S. loss in heartbreaking fashion in overtime.
This is On Point. I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook. In other sports stories this year, Olympic track star Alicia Montano runs the 800 meters in the U.S. Track and Field Championships while 8 months pregnant.
I just knew I didn't want to get lapped, be the first person ever to get lapped in the 800. But more than anything, I wanted to be here, and I'm feeling that fire and that desire to be on the track and to race.
Derek Jeter wrapped up his epic career at Yankee Stadium in high style. The legendary shortstop, always amazing, drove in the winning run.
Richardson scores on a base hit by Derek Jeter. Is that unbelievable? Or is that unbelievable?
And 19-year-old skater Jason Brown won over many, including in our studio. He was on the show in January with a Riverdance-inspired performance at the National Championships that punched his ticket to the Olympics. Olympic gold medalist and NBC analyst Scott Hamilton was blown away. I think Scott Hamilton needs to get more excited about stuff. I really do. We're talking about the top sports stories of 2014, and you can join the conversation. Can sports and athletes still inspire us? Shira Springer, columnist and sports reporter for the Boston Globe, is with us, and so is Kevin Blackstone, sports writer and panelist for the ESPN show Around the Horn. Let's take some calls and hear what's on other people's minds about what were their big stories from this year. This David, who's calling from Atlanta, Georgia. Hello, David.
Hey, Michelle, how are you?
Good. What's your top sports story?
Yeah, Mike, it's funny. Top sports stories, you guys talked about the Cup. I'm a huge fan of the beautiful game, but I think about 2014, and I'm not a baseball fan. I don't particularly like it, but you played that clip. Derek Jeter is, to me, an athlete that kind of cut through all the garbledygook of what has been sports and all the, you know, he is just a guy who played the game almost in an unheard-of way for one team his entire career, and retired as a pre-outstanding guy. And it's one of those people that I wouldn't exactly tell my kids. I don't think sports guys are role models, but if there's one guy out there, I said, you know, kids, this is a guy, look at and look at what he's done. Derek Jeter just really kind of cut through a lot of the stuff. He doesn't get a lot of play anymore now that he's retired, but I think he was just a fantastic athlete, and I think one of the great stories of 2014 and probably of baseball.
Thank you, David. You know, Kevin, one of the things that Derek Jeter has done, started this just before he retired, is set up the Players Tribune, which is an outlet for athletes to write about things that are on their minds. And I think it's interesting. I mean, he's already kind of made some noise with it. I remember Russell Wilson wrote a piece about bullying, about how right. You know, he was a bully as a young kid, which I found surprising because a lot of people think of him as kind of one of those good guys of the sport. So what do you think mm-hmm. about Derek Jeter?
Derek Jeter is almost the embodiment of perfect. I mean, the guy, there's nothing bad you can say about him. And if you think you're going to say something bad about him, you better look over your shoulder. For anyone who is in their early 20s, Derek Jeter is the greatest baseball player they ever saw. I mean, he came into the league 20 years ago and was Rookie of the Year, went on to play in five World Series, was the MVP in one of them, was an All-Star basically every year, almost every year. And just the way he handled himself in the city of New York, of all places, without a hint of scandal. Even the worst thing that could be said about him was the story that was manufactured. He gave gift baskets to his girlfriends after an evening out, let's say, and gave him a limo home. The guys in East, I just don't know what you can say about. I don't know that he will be able to top his athletic life in his post-athletic life. It was so perfect.
Let's hear from James, who's calling from Woodstock, New York. James, what was your top sports story of 2014?
Hi, Michelle. Nothing to, with Derek Jeter aside, I would propose the most classiest athlete of all time is Roger Federer, and the comeback that he had this year as the old man that he was written off last year, and how he came back this year. I think Roger Federer inspires, and tennis inspires, and I'm wondering why it never gets much press.
I don't know, Shira. Does it?
I think it's,
I don't know. Well, I live
exception
in Washington, D.C., and we get a lot of, because, you know, Venus and Serena are still, I mean, they are royalty there, major supporters of, you know, youth tennis efforts and things of that sort. So
yeah,
maybe where I live, I have a different perspective. Shira, what do you think?
I was going to say, beyond, I think, Serena and Venus Williams, there aren't many American stars, full-fledged, true stars at the top of the sport. So I think if there aren't top Americans in the game. It doesn't interest Americans as much, and it's going sort of – the stars are more overseas European, so I think that's a huge factor. But let's not forget Serena Williams had a great year too, and she keeps winning at her age as well. And it's just – you know, that is a very impressive part of the sport that I agree doesn't get recognized as much.
Let's talk about another issue. You know, both you and Kevin talked about this being a year of change. This was a very big year, I think, for LGBT athletes, people who want to both play their sport and be open, you know, about their lives. And Michael Sam
year.
Being drafted and Jason Collins getting a contract to play in the NBA, Michael Sam being drafted by the NFL was huge. And this was not just, you know, athletes or people outside the LGBT or LGBT activists. So these are people inside the sport who are, you know, straight athletes also advocating. I just want to play a short clip from last February where longtime Dallas sportscaster Dale Hansen ripped pro football executives and others who balked when the University of Missouri's Michael Sam joined the NFL after coming out and announcing he was gay. This is what he had to say.
Michael Sam would be the first openly gay player in the NFL, says he knows there will be problems and they've already started. Several NFL officials telling Sports Illustrated it will hurt him on draft day because a gay player wouldn't be welcome in an NFL locker room. It would be uncomfortable because that's a man's world. You beat a woman and drag her down a flight of stairs, pulling her hair out by the roots, you're the fourth guy taken in the NFL draft. You kill people while driving drunk, that guy's welcome. Players caught in hotel rooms with illegal drugs and prostitutes, we know they're welcome. Players accused of rape and pay the woman to go away. You lie to police trying to cover up a murder, we're comfortable with that. You love another man, well, now you've gone too far.
But Kevin, I mean, he was drafted but didn't make it onto an NFL field this season, which happens perhaps more often than some people might think it does. But what do you think about that overall? I mean, do you think that it was maybe, I don't know, was it a hollow victory for him?
You know, I'm not sure it was a hollow victory. I still think it was a step. It wasn't the biggest step that could have been taken. But I thought it was interesting that he was drafted. I thought it was interesting that he didn't make the cut at the Rams, but the Dallas Cowboys then went out and picked him up to see if he could help them. And I don't think that Michael Sam's career is necessarily over as a professional football player. His narrative got ahead of his metrics as a football player, and he was going to be a difficult fit no matter. And I did think it exposed the NFL and some of the hypocrisy that Dale Hansen, who I know, pointed out. I thought it also raised this conversation that needed to be had. And I thought it's interesting that since then, slowly but surely, some other athletes, some other people in sports have come out, most notably just a couple weeks ago, or maybe just a week ago, Dale Scott, who's a longtime, well-known umpire in Major League Baseball. And he came out and introduced everyone to his spouse. And I thought that was pretty impressive. And I'm not sure that he would have done that had Michael Sam not done what he did and had Jason Collins not gotten a 10-day contract after he came out the closet.
Sherry, do you see any analogies between the issues that women in major sports face and that LGBT athletes, you know, face? Just in terms of, it's interesting because obviously LGBT athletes can be male or female or transgender or identify as, you know, transgender, but just in this kind of continually looking for acceptance or looking for respect for their accomplishments. I don't know. You mentioned that it was a big year for women in a number of arenas and a number of sports. But it's just interesting to me that we're still talking about it.
Yeah,
this is half the population. I just find it interesting that we're still talking about women in sports as its own issue.
Yeah, well, I think that you know, I don't think there will ever be a day where we're not talking about women in sports as its own issue.
Why not? Why?
Because I think there's just a different perspective when it comes to female athletes, that they're always going to be fighting for acceptance, that there are always going to be people out there who say women's sports aren't as interesting because the women aren't as big and aren't as strong and aren't as fast as male athletes, and therefore aren't as entertaining, and therefore don't deserve my time, my fandom, my, you know, money paid toward tickets and merchandise. So I think there's always going to be that inequality that women will have to battle. I think we are a long, long way, unfortunately, from days when, you know, women are going to have even a measure of equality in terms of how they're perceived as athletes.
I think we have time to take one more call. Louise is calling from Waterbury, Vermont. Louise, what was your big year in sports? What was your favorite story?
Hi, Michelle. Yes. So I'd like to talk a little bit about women's role in sports. And this year I was a part of an all-female free ride ski film produced out of Jackson Hole called Pretty Faces. And the goal was to highlight women in skiing, but to talk about this gender difference a little bit. And I think that the take home for me after this big project was that there is this institutionalization that women are lesser athletes. And I think that more and more athletic women are really trying to break down the idea that we're not as fast and we're not as strong, and highlight the idea that we're just different athletes. We are capable of different things. We are more elegant when we play a lot of sports, and we enjoy different things like community with other women when we go outside. And I think that a lot of these things are overlooked, and it's something that the sports industry, I think, definitely is slow to catch on to. But this grassroots movement that's happening, I think, is really influencing how role models appear in sports. You know, it has been a big year for role models with women. And I think that that's only going to increase because women are really grasping onto these other women who are really high profile, because it shows that there's something to work toward.
Okay. All right. Louise, thank you so much for calling. Well, you know, there was, as Shira mentioned, a couple of names earlier. The 13-year-old Monet Davis, breakout star of this year's Little League World Series and Sports Illustrated Sports Kid of the Year. She can throw a 70-mile-an-hour fastball. And here she is speaking to ESPN about her strategy on the pitcher's mound.
Some people might not like it low and outside, so I'll throw it low and outside. Some people like swing at curveball. Some people swing at first pitch, so I know when to throw the right pitch at the right time, and I have to make sure that all my pitches are working that day.
And Shira, you also mentioned the San Antonio Spurs hiring Becky Hammond, the first full-time paid female coach. She's an assistant coach in the NBA, and she says don't focus on that. So this is what she had to say.
Mm-hmm. The bigger point is I'm getting hired because I'm capable because of my basketball IQ and stuff that they've seen in me personally.
All right, Shira?
Yeah, I think it's interesting, especially with...
You sure you want to take back those words that we'll always be talking about this?
I think I think it's clear we always will be. And I think the caller brings up a good point about there having to be role models out there for female athletes. And I know that's what her film was putting out there. But I also think women in sports have always faced this sort of dilemma. They want to be role models, but they also can't be marketed as just role models. They have to be marketed as athletes, as exceptional athletes, to get that following. And there's always this sort of push and pull. Do we want to have the female athletes be role models to the younger generation, or do we want to push them out there as exceptional athletes? And with that, I think the WNBA this year redesigned its logo to make it a more athletic logo. So I think there are those issues that are going to keep coming up.
So what have we missed? Let's see. Some of our listeners' favorite sports stories from a listener on Facebook. Nathan says says Vanderbilt wins the baseball championship but can barely field a competitive football team. There's something to be said about intelligence standards here and the sports that attract intelligence. A little controversial there, Nathan. I don't know. I think a lot of people would disagree with you or want to argue with you about the... It takes a lot of smarts to play football, I think. Jason Saul says, a story on the mascot of New Orleans pro basketball team, the Pelicans. Pierre the Pelican suffered a broken beak during a pickup game and underwent surgery. He then reappeared with a redesigned face. And let's see, the 2014, Ian Barry says, the 2014 Surfing World Championship will be determined in the coming days with a final showdown at the Banzai Pipeline between reigning world champion Mick Fanning, the season's favorite 19-year-old Gabriel Medina. I think, Kevin, you're probably going to volunteer to cover this, right?
That'd be great.
What did we miss, Kevin? Anything we missed?
Well, I thought the Kansas City Royals run in the postseason of the baseball playoffs, I thought that was really great and inspiring. We always have to talk about who won all the championships because those are always great stories. And you started talking about Russell Wilson and the job that he was able to do with the Seattle Seahawks. And I also thought that Richard Sherman and his voice, since we started out talking about protest and voice, I thought he gave people a real lesson, the media in particular, fans in general, about who and what a black man can be in this country. Okay. I really liked Richard Sherman's start to this season.
All right, well, we have to leave it there for now. Kevin Blackistone, sports writer and panelist for the ESPN show Around the Horn. Kevin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Shira Springer, sports reporter and columnist for the Boston Globe. Thank you so much for joining me here.
Thank you.
And listeners, thank you for all your calls and suggestions. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, a big Sony hack gets weirder and wider. Hollywood and Homeland Security are on edge. I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.